Thank you, David. It's nice to be back in Highgate. The passage from Joel is the one that we all think we know really well because, generally speaking, we read the words that suit us just fine. The lovely, comforting words about old men having dreams and young men having visions. Tickety-boo and wonderful. Isn't it amazing how selective our eyes can be? Or our powers of discernment. And that's why you may think, as a visiting guest preacher this morning, I rather spoiled the words of Joel by deliberately inviting the poor reader to read the verses, "I will remove the northerner far from you and drive him into a parched and desolate land." This has got nothing to do with the land of my birth or any political sentiments that might or might not be shared in the congregation today. But it is a reminder that in everything we encounter in the written text, in the scriptures, there is a context. The other element was harvest, and a sense that there was a land of plenty, but a reminder in the prophecy that what is given to us can just as quickly be taken from us. The ancient but entirely relevant and contemporary insight that we never quite know what's coming next. It can be as if you were sitting behind a large truck, and many of us will have seen the words, "If you can't see my mirrors, I can't see you." And of course, we're becoming more aware on our roads of the dangers of not being able to see one another, and in particular, not being able to see cyclists. There are rather more cyclists in Highgate than there are in Northwood. But that feeling of not being able to see ahead, and feeling a sense of anxiety, therefore, about the living of our own days. David asked me at the 11th hour and the 59th minute for a title for the sermon or address or chat. And I decided that I would call it wryly, "The Eyes Have It." Here is an image by Sebastian Francy of the blind leading the blind. And if you can make out the image, what you can see is a whole bunch of people about to ford a stream. And down in the corner, there is a picture of it looks like an English sheepdog to me. Sorry about that, Samuel. But the only way they are going to make it across the stream is by hanging on to one another. I'm sure we've all done that exercise in management techniques or whatever we call it, where you have to take somebody blindfolded and move them round the room. We all went through that palaver in the 1980s and all discovered that actually the process of leading somebody, helping somebody to find their way, is quite a skill. It takes a fairly deft hand, but more than just a hand, it takes a sense of who the person is that you are trying to guide. And how apposite is that in these days of vast shifts in the landscape of our political world, of our business world, and indeed of our church world as well. Who guides us, those of us who feel or think of ourselves as being the guides? I guess it comes down to trust. That's hugely important. This is a powerful image when you know the whole story. You may be able to guess that while there is a guide leading, there is a skier behind who is blind. And the skier is, in the story I'm about to tell, a skier who became a Paralympian, skiing for silver and bronze, skiing at speeds upwards of 65 miles an hour. In the days before the technologies existed, which meant that you had to have a human being guiding you down the ski slope. Just think about that for a moment. Just think about the skills required of the ski guide shouting out the instructions. And just think about the trust of the skier behind. Many of us are now driving in cars with technologies that, if they don't exactly encourage us to take our hands off the wheel, suggest to us that sometimes it is possible to take our hands off the wheel. I try it occasionally, handing over to the technology. At 60 miles an hour on a motorway, I'm not quite there with the trust thing just yet. I pretty soon get hold of the wheel again. Manifestly today, we're thinking about sight and trust. And I want to suggest today there is an incredibly strong link between them, and it hasn't just got to do with what you see. There are numerous stories in the scriptures of people having their sight restored. And indeed, it doesn't take much to work out that these stories hail from a time where there were many people, not just Jesus, there were many people claiming that they could restore people's sights. There were many miracle workers. Interesting, isn't it, that nothing particularly changes. We still live in a world where there are those who would claim they can work latter-day miracles. What was this business of the sight being restored all about, and why does it feature so much in the Christian Gospels? It has, I want to suggest you, to do with the status of a person who is blind. Because although it might seem crazy to us, a person would be regarded as blind as that being an aspect of God's will and determination. Why me? That horrible, haunting question. A blind person, just as a leper, would not be granted access to the temple. It would be impossible for a blind person to offer his or her praise to God in that holy place. So to restore a person's sight would be not just to give them back their sight, it would be to give them access to the temple, to the place of worship, to find their rightful place again in the scheme of things. It does beg the question, therefore, when sight was restored, what does the person who regains his or her sight see? But more importantly, or at least as importantly, what does that person experience? Have you ever been with somebody at the moment when they regain their sight? No, neither have I. But I've watched a program where it happens. And I remember some years ago, I can remember vividly this because I was teaching just down the road at King Alfred School. And I used the story over and over again in our PSHE classes of Mike Mays. Mike Mays is the skier, and he is a remarkable human being. He had the opportunity of sight being restored through the gift of stem cell technologies. He lost his sight in a horrific accident in a school chemistry laboratory when he was a boy. He had acclimatized to being a person of extremely limited sight, virtually none. He became an accomplished downhill skier. I like the quotation that goes with this image from Soren Kierkegaard. To dare is to lose one's footing momentarily. Not to dare is to lose one's self. So let's remove ourselves from the ski slopes and let's think about ourselves in the context of, well, the church. How much of our thinking in the church is safe thinking? How much of our thinking in the church is the equivalent to going down the ski slope at a very nice 15 miles an hour, thank you very much? Where does it get us? And where's the sense of exhilaration? Where's the risk that we say the gospel is all about? Where is the trust in our guide? It's just a question. But I do think we play a remarkably safe game in the church. And I don't think that the gospel calls us to live lives that are safe. There was nothing risk-free about Mike Mays signing up to technologies that hadn't been proven. But the day came where the bandages were removed. And the first person that Mike Mays saw as the bandage was removed was his wife. Now, remember this, folks. He had never seen his wife. Risky? Do you want to know what his first word was when he saw his wife? Wow! And the second word was honey. Which must have come as an enormous relief to his wife. Mike's remarkable journey to a level of healing caught the attention of psychologists the world over, and there have been many studies asked, of course, because we would all want to ask, what are the best and worst things about recovering some vision? And Mike responds with these words. The best was fulfilling my curiosity and realizing that it wasn't as big a deal as the world would perceive it to be. It wasn't as big a deal as the world would perceive it to be. Quit all the fuss. Just let me get on with the next hugely important part of my journey of acclimatizing to this strange experience of seeing things and then grappling with what you see. Which sounds straightforward. Except. There's always an except, isn't there? What do you see? And how do you process what you see? He goes on. The worst is seeing a homeless person laying on the street. You can tap them with your cane or walk around them with your dog. But it is not the same as seeing them and knowing that that is where they live. This photograph, incidentally, I struggle with Google because you can get any number of lovely pictures of people suffering off Google. And it becomes a kind of middle-class endeavor, doesn't it? A kind of intellectual, we've got nice images. But that image I can just about live with as part of a presentation because in actual fact it was taken by a Latvian who had lived on the streets of London and who became himself an accomplished photographer. And it just is interesting that there is that synergy between two people who had a great deal in common because the photographer once upon a time himself had lived on the streets. And of course, this image reminds us of the gospel passage we've read. This guy who's got his sight restored. Isn't that the guy? Isn't
isn't that the beggar we used to walk past every day on the way to the temple? And I love the final line of that passage, because it doesn't let us off the hook. Where is the guy that did this? I don't know. I like that in the gospel it says, I don't know. The miracle, the mystery, is left hanging. And we have to conjure with it, and we have to make sense of it. Where did he go, this miracle worker? Is he still around in our lives today? Do we know? Do we ask? Should we? I want to tell you the story of a man, I can promise you it will be a short story, a man called S.B. He was always known as S.B. in the literature, the psychological literature and journals. He features alongside the story of Mike Mays, because S.B. also was blind. S.B. was born in Birmingham in England. He was born in the 1950s. The truth be told, he was a bit of a dour character. He wasn't known for his humour. But he was a good mender of shoes and became a cobbler by trade, or a shoemaker. He lived with his blindness. He had been born with congenital blindness. Yet, even with remarkably basic medical technologies compared to those we have at our fingertips today, there was the possibility of some sight being restored through corneal ingraft. And that's what happened. And S.B. had his sight restored. People were fascinated by his story. How would he adjust? And he found the adjustment difficult. He wouldn't think twice about crossing a busy road. But with his sight restored, he clocked the speed of the cars. He couldn't judge distances. All that stuff was completely perplexing to him with his sight. So he had to be almost manhandled across the road by his friends. An accomplished cobbler, everybody would say, wow, you must be able to do much better now that you can actually see what you're doing. But he was completely befuddled by what he was doing. One of his first trips with sightedness was to the Science Museum to look at machines that reflected our industrial heritage, because he was fascinated by machines, because, of course, he had worked with machines in the most intricate of ways. But with his sight restored, oddly, his confidence drifted from him. He talks very powerfully, as does Mike Mays indeed, about how even with your sight restored, you have to continue to touch in order to see, if you think about that. And you think about how much that we see with sight, even those of us with assisted sight. Would you know what you were seeing unless at some point you had touched it? I wonder. S.B. Sydney focused all the time with his sightedness on things that were untidy. You could see a whole lot of perfect paintwork, but all he would really register would be the bit of the paintwork that was chipped or damaged. I have to say, from my own kind of bizarre psychology, I can slightly identify with that. I'm incapable of not seeing these marks on that wall over there, but, you know. But what S.B. experienced was something to a much greater pitch. What was called the dirt and the flaking paintwork of a disappointing world. You might think that S.B., with the benefit of sight restored, would have retired a happy man. He didn't. He died. And he died with a series of illnesses, really, that could be broadly put under the one umbrella of depression. Sight restored did S.B. no favours. I'm going to wrap up quickly. We never quite know where God is going to put us next. Any of us, be warned. It's true. I find, while I hadn't planned it, I'm now working also as chaplain to the Merchant Taylors School near my home in Northwood. And almost every week I walk under this remarkable owl. And I've often wondered about the story of the owl. There are the three letters which indicate from the Greek that there is an Ionian connection of the Athenians. And indeed, there is a powerful punch to this little story. The owl's eyes. Owl's eyes are amazing because they're part of a kind of very complicated structure in the face that links the eyes and the hearing mechanism incredibly closely, like a great sound dish. So the owl can hear the most amazing amount of detail from miles away and see everything. But not because the owl necessarily just has good eyesight, but because of the physiology of the owl. How far over your shoulder can you see? Try it. No matter how slowly and deliberately and deftly you, there is an absolute limit. You actually have to start turning, but the owl doesn't. The owl is all seeing. Sometimes in life, it would be good to be able to see what's going on behind your back. For the best of us, and for the least of us, and perhaps even for the gods. There she is, Athena, the goddess of wisdom, but also war. And guess what else she's goddess of? Strategy. The owl is always associated with the goddess. Not because the goddess is all-seeing, all-knowing, all this, all that, but precisely because she isn't all-seeing. She has a blind side. So every time she makes a big strategic decision, she will be the benefit of what the owl can see, but perhaps she cannot. So, now that's going to be tricky to read. Some thoughts as we journey together. Let's keep our eyes wide open, and our hearts and our minds as well. Let's remember those we share the journey with, whether we can see them or otherwise. And let's remember this also as Christians, that being kind is infinitely more important than being clever. God is not inviting us to be miracle workers, but he is inviting us to love this fractured world that sometimes we wish we could hide our eyes from. And then let's trust even in those things we cannot see. For that is the measure of true faith, is it not? Amen.